I next met with Dr. Jason Luke from the University of Chicago, and to begin, he discussed the use of immune checkpoint blockade in the KEYNOTE-37 trial of epacadostat in combination with pembrolizumab for patients with melanoma.
The field of immune checkpoint blockade for melanoma and for all cancers is rapidly advancing. And the backbone of therapy in that sort of setting is really PD-1 antibodies. But the next generation is coming forward, and it's not totally clear on which targets would be most ideal to combine with PD-1. And at the University of Chicago and a number of other investigators have really been interested in the interaction between the tumor-infiltrating lymphocyte and the tumor in the tumor microenvironment. And so we're aware that when T cells get activated in the tumor microenvironment, they elaborate the cytokine interferon gamma. And that's a particularly important cytokine for driving the productive anti-tumor immune response. In response to interferon gamma, tumors can upregulate PD-L1, which is why we think PD-1 blocking antibodies have their activity. It turns out that other pathways are also upregulated in the context of an interferon gamma associated response, and particularly one that's important is indolamine dioxygenase. And so multiple inhibitors of indolamine dioxygenase have come forward, and the most advanced of them is epacadostat. And so there's a rationale then in the context of tumor-infiltrating lymphocytes elaborating interferon gamma and upregulating PD-L1 and IDO together, it then makes sense to combine pembrolizumab, a PD-1 antibody, with epacadostat and IDO inhibitors. And that is really the basis for the phase 1-2 clinical trial that was presented at ESMO. It's been presented at multiple meetings prior to this, where we've observed that whereas with a monotherapy PD-1 antibody, we'd expect a response rate on the order of 40%, here with this combination, albeit in a single-arm, non-randomized controlled study, we see a response rate on the order of 60%. Similarly, whereas we see the PFS with monotherapy PD-1 antibody at about 6 months, with the combination, we're seeing things out more closer to a year. So again, these are small data sets, but they really suggest that there could be a powerful combination regimen with PD-1 plus IDO inhibition.
So I'm trying to kind of remember what it means when something ends with stat. And so it's a small molecule, right?
Correct.
So what kind of small molecule, and is there any toxicity?
So epacadostat, or most of the IDO inhibitors as a class, inhibit the enzyme IDO1. So it is a small molecule inhibitor of the active site in the enzyme that converts tryptophan, the amino acid, into kynurenine. And that process, it turns out, we're learning more and more, appears to be very specific to the tumor microenvironment or an interferon gamma response. So you would be concerned if you are adding checkpoints, you might get more toxicity. But it turns out that in the clinical trials to date, both for the combination of pembro and epacadostat, but also for other IDO inhibitors, there really is no suggestion of increased toxicity relative to what you would see with a PD-1 antibody alone. And we think that's because it's this interferon gamma-associated T-cell activation that's really only present in the tumor microenvironment, so that by inhibiting this enzyme, it's not really of relevance anywhere else in the body, and therefore you're not generating more systemic toxicity.
You know, just thinking about it, I hadn't thought about this before, but from your point of view, let's maybe just talk about, say, an anti-PD-1 antibody to start with, and then maybe get into these other things. Do you think that essentially all the toxicity is autoimmune, or do you think there's like some more traditional type of toxicity that you see with these agents?
Well, when thinking about toxicity in the context of checkpoint blockade, it is important to recognize that there could be two categories. There's just straight up drug toxicity,
right,
like we historically thought of for chemotherapy, but really the major toxicities we worry about are these immune-related adverse events.
So, I mean, for example, I hear about these skin changes. Do you think they're sort of a drug type of effect or autoimmune?
So dermatitis or cutaneous eruptions in the context of checkpoint blockade have actually been shown to mostly be immune-related. So you can do biopsies of the skin and see infiltration of lymphocytes, and that's commonly thought of as the most likely source. Now, whether or not there's also an aspect of just straight-up drug toxicity, I think that's a little bit of an open question. But broadly speaking, for PD-1 antibodies, that's not considered to be the major mechanism. I will note, however, that as we bring other combination partners forward, like, say, a small molecule IDO inhibitor, we will need to be cognizant of everything else that we learned about cancer drug development over the past several decades, that these drugs in and of themselves could have direct toxicities. So the one toxicity that was observed to perhaps be slightly increased with the combination of Pembro plus epacadostat was dermatitis. And there, it's a kind of an open question as to whether or not that's truly an immune-related issue or a drug-specific issue. Along those same lines, there's recent data of nivolumab plus the IDO inhibitor known as BMS-986205. And in that combination, they saw a slight increase in hepatic toxicity. Again, only slight, but again, raises this question of, are there drug-specific properties or is this an immune-related adverse event? I think some of these questions are really only going to be teased out in the phase 3 trials that are starting to be launched now, where you're going to have randomized populations who either get PD-1 monotherapy or the combo, and to really try to look at both efficacy and toxicity there. But it is a wide open question. As we get combination regimens, sort of pulling apart the different toxicity profiles will be difficult between the different agents.
Yeah, and thinking about it also in terms of, for example, epacadostat, it sounds like you're saying that you don't see an obvious increase in autoimmune problems. Is that the case?
Yeah, that's correct.
So that the related question is, why do you see so many problems with anti-CTLA-4 agents like ipilimumab? What's the biology of why you see worse toxicity?
Right. So that's a really good point. And so the difference is that blockade of CTLA-4, dogmatically speaking, has been described as being a peripheral immune effect, meaning at the point of T-cell activation, CTLA-4 acts to dampen initial T-cell activation. So you get a much more global activation of the adaptive immune response in the context of CTLA-4 blockade. That's in contrast to the interferon gamma-associated tumor microenvironmental changes. So if a T-cell upregulates gamma in the tumor microenvironment and you get PD-L1 and IDO upregulated, that effect, we believe, is really only happening in the context of the tumor microenvironment, and therefore we have less of an off-target, sort of in quotes, sort of effect of peripheral immune activation.
It's funny, sometimes I ask people questions and I just assume somebody out there smarter than me is going to understand what you're talking about, but I do get some of it. Anyhow, one other thing about other immune targets, again, you know, it's just sort of hearing people talk, I've heard things about other checkpoints like so-called TIM-3 and LAG-3. What are they, and what are some of the other immune strategies that particularly integrate with checkpoint inhibitors that you think are most promising?
Absolutely. So as we really drill down and focus on what's happening in the tumor microenvironment at the point of attack between a T-cell and the tumor, we recognize that it's not all just PD-L1. But it does all stem off of this biology of the T-cell elaborating cytokines and the tumor doing things in response. So one of those is IDO, as we talked about, but there are other things that happen to that T-cell as it sits in the context of the tumor. And just like in autoimmunity, where you have an antigen that the immune system can't clear, your T-cells, if they're in the tumor microenvironment, will become progressively dysfunctional. And that can be observed in the context of which receptors are shown on the surface of the cell. And so one that's become especially of interest is one known as LAG-3. That molecule is upregulated both in parallel but also in sequence with PD-1, and it's another marker of T-cell energy or, quote, exhaustions, close quote. And so the idea then is, could we block LAG-3 and potentially reverse that exhausted state and get those T-cells to be functional in the tumor microenvironment again? And data has been presented now at multiple meetings for the anti-LAG-3 antibody relatlimab, and there are phase 3 clinical trials of nivolumab plus relatlimab coming forward for refractory melanoma, and I think in other disease settings as well. LAG-3 is not the only T-cell exhaustion checkpoint, however. Another that's of interest is TIM-3. And there are a number of other receptors that are also of interest, like OX40, CD137, and a host of other ones that are also targets for drug development in terms of trying to relieve this exhausted state or to try to push T-cells to be more functional.
How close are we to maybe moving into a situation where we're going to know which of these to use? You know, the old personalized oncology concept. Do you think that's coming to immunotherapy?
So I absolutely believe that this concept of personalized immuno-oncology is coming, and I think it's coming sooner than people think about. Currently, we're treating populations of patients and retrospectively doing immunohistochemistries, but I can tell you that I'm going to be the principal investigator for a trial that we're calling ADVISE, or the Adaptive Trial After Nivolumab Resistance, to look at specifically prospectively profiling tumors by immunohistochemistry to look for which receptors are upregulated and then put patients into buckets based on what we find on their immunohistochemistries.
It kind of reminds me of, I think there's some stuff like in lung cancer that did it that way.
So the trial you're referencing was at the dawn of targeted therapy, there was a study known as the BATTLE trial.
The BATTLE trial.
That was done
Roy
at MD Herbst
and them. Right? Yeah, right.
So it's a very similar sort of concept. But beyond just that, we're excited about this because we think not only could we profile by immunohistochemistry, but could we actually even drill down and then do in parallel gene expression profiling to look at RNA-based genomics, because maybe in the future we could do genomics instead of immunohistochemistries, because that would really open up the world to be a much more robust biomarker.
What's the name of the study again?
The ADVISE study.
Okay. Another paper I want to ask you about, this little sort of informal journal club, is a paper you are involved with, Diagnostic Comparison of CT Scans and Colonoscopy for Immune-Related Colitis with Ipilimumab-Treated Melanoma Patients. So I'm always curious about colitis in general, not just so much with Ipi or CTLA-4, but you know, you hear about it with checkpoint inhibitors sometimes. I mean, we're hearing about bladder cancer, and everybody's using checkpoint inhibitors now, and it doesn't seem that common with, you know, just that without the anti-CTLA-4, but you hear about it. And I'm very interested in what you looked at here to further understand really how these should be managed.
Absolutely. So management of immune-related adverse events is probably the most difficult aspect of immunotherapy for practicing physicians who don't have a background in this. And I would say that it's really the opportunity for us to put our internal medicine differential diagnosis hats back on. But in this investigation, what we looked at was patients who presented with diarrhea who then were admitted to the hospital, and the comparison between those that had colonoscopies to get histology compared to the CT scan findings when they came in. So on the clinical trials of the various checkpoint inhibitors, it was very much recommended that if people got sick, that we were very aggressive in trying to determine the etiology of what happened. And therefore, on the ipilimumab clinical trials, almost everyone got a colonoscopy. As these checkpoint antibodies have exploded and moved into clinical trials all over the place, it's become less frequent that people do the colonoscopy. They're more likely to treat empirically. But an open question then was, like, how much of this are we really missing? And I think that this was a useful investigation because what was shown was in the context of patients at the Dana-Farber treated with ipilimumab, that those that presented and had a CT scan that showed stranding or evidence of a colitis process by radiomics, almost 100% of the time, it was above 95% of the time, had colitis when they had a scope. So to the point that then in general practice, if there's a high pretest probability that the drug is causing this problem, this diarrhea syndrome, then it's probably unnecessary to do a colonoscopy in all of these patients. The key caveat that I would make there, however, though, is there are some investigations that you can do without admitting a patient that really should be done. So many of our patients are exposed to antibiotics, or they're in the hospital or around a healthcare setting quite often. So it's really essential that practicing physicians check for things like C. diff. And they ask patients just general history elements like, you know, has anybody else in your family been sick, and so on and so forth, because it does happen that we get confused and that occasionally we do these colonoscopies and we do find the patient actually has C. diff or something else. And you don't want to miss that, because if you just start someone on steroids, it can potentially do two problematic things. One is steroids are by no means benign. They cause a lot of side effects in and of themselves. And secondarily, if you confuse the situation and you tell the person that they're refractory to immunotherapy, depending on what the disease setting is, you may have eliminated a very significant treatment option for that person. So I tend to be rather dogmatic about it. I'll check C. diff and some of these things. Despite this paper, I still have a lower threshold for really doing a colonoscopy, especially if I start outpatient steroids and patients don't get better very quickly. But generally speaking, if your pretest probability is high that this drug is causing this problem and you do some, you know, relatively minimal investigations in the outpatient setting, you can feel confident to give steroids in this setting.
What is it that they see on colonoscopy that's useful?
So you'll see, generally speaking, and it depends on, because the spectrum of effect for colitis can be quite broad. If you catch it early, you'll really just see sort of erythematous pink mucosa that just looks inflamed. If it goes on for more than a week or two, however, you can start to see patches, you know, holes in the colon, quite honestly. So colitis that really is histologically obvious, but even clinically is obvious that the colon just looks really beat up, just like inflammatory bowel disease. And if you do, you know, cold forceps punch, you can see penetration into the epithelial layers of various different types of immune cells, both CD4 and CD8 T cells, as well as macrophages. And it can really be a range of what you can see, anything from microscopic colitis to full-on inflammatory bowel disease-like histology.
But you can learn something from the histology?
Well, yes, because sometimes actually when we do a colonoscopy in these patients, we actually don't see evidence of friable mucosa that is just sort of super obvious from a clinical perspective. And so I tell my colleagues in gastroenterology that even if they go in there and they're not convinced just by visual inspection, I ask them to please do random biopsies, because it's commonly the case actually that we will pick up in the histology the presence of this colitis syndrome, which if we didn't know what was going on, we might not have done that, and we would still be stuck with a patient who has diarrhea, but we don't know how to treat them.
So I don't recall anybody, maybe everybody knows this, but I don't recall anybody mentioning the idea that CT scan can suggest or make the diagnosis of immune colitis or colitis more generically.
Yeah, well, so colitis more generally, you can definitely pick up stranding or inflammation in bowel segments on a CT scan. And so then again, it goes into the, so your general internal medicine practice, and that if you have a high pretest probability for colitis and you get a CT scan that shows inflammation, you know, you can put two and two together there. Again, it requires, though, there are other reasons that people could have colitis, so you don't want to miss something else that would be treated in a different fashion.
And in general, do you view colitis that comes as a secondary effect of, for example, anti-PD-1 therapy alone as kind of qualitatively the same as what you see with anti-CTLA-4, just more of it with CTLA-4 or the combination?
Yeah, so that's the right way to think about it. These are class effects, and it's just their incidence that's different. So with CTLA-4 blockade, it's obviously greater than with PD-1 blockade, and with the combo together, it's even higher. But yeah, generally speaking, they are the same. Now, the intensity of them will also vary, so that with ipilimumab alone, the intensity of the colitis is commonly greater than with PD-1 blockade, and certainly with the combination, when patients get colitis, we're going to be more likely to be aggressive with anti-TNF agents and super high doses of steroids very quickly, because this is the kind of thing that can really spin and become problematic.
Do you think that some of these patients, or maybe a lot of them, have sort of underlying autoimmune bowel disease that's being reactivated, that's subclinical, is being made clinical? Or do you think these are totally normal bowels that become, you know, diseased?
So it's a very good question about what is the underlying pathophysiology that leads to immune-related adverse events. And that's actually a major area of research in the field. I actually agree with what you suggested surrounding the idea that some patients have sort of, you might think about it as a higher immunological rheostat in terms of if they're just primed a little, they're ready to go into an autoimmune state. So there are T cells that are antigen specific for something in the bowel that are normally controlled by your natural mechanisms to suppress autoimmunity. But by just relieving these checkpoints, that's enough to get them into play such that you start to get clinical symptoms. Now, how frequent that is just in the general population is sort of unknown. You know, we would call those people normal, but then in the context of this intervention that we made against cancer, they become abnormal. So I think it's a little bit hard because I don't know that we necessarily have the right categories for this, just in the way we usually think about clinical medicine.
So one other question related to some recent papers, or just the topic I want to throw out at you, is the issue of brain mets with melanoma. And I see that there were a couple of papers at ASCO looking at checkpoint inhibitors in people with brain mets. But also, I'm curious what we know about responsiveness of brain mets to PD-1 antibodies alone, and also targeted therapy, and sort of how you integrate systemic therapy into their management.
So absolutely. Brain metastases in melanoma is really sort of the last frontier where we haven't made the kind of progress that we wish that we had, although we're starting to get there. It's been known for a long time that BRAF inhibitors as monotherapies, even when it was just vemurafenib, had activity in brain mets, though it was attenuated relative to what we saw systemically. Similarly, we know that PD-1 antibodies do have a response rate in the brain, though again, it's not kind of what we would want. So at ASCO 2017, there were a couple of different presentations. One was on dabrafenib trametinib, specifically in the population of patients with brain metastases. And what we saw there was that the response rate looked quite impressive. So systemically, we look for sort of a 60 to 80% response rate. And that's similar to what was seen in the brain metastases population. Now, a difference, however, was that whereas in cutaneous disease in the phase 3 trials, the progression-free survival was on the order of about 11 to 12 months. In the brain metastases population, that progression-free survival was more about 6 months. So while it's still a very useful therapy, it definitely was attenuated in terms of long-term benefit. Put that in contrast, however, with the ipilimumab plus nivolumab immunotherapy combination, which showed, again, a similar response rate in brain to seem to what was seen systemically with on the order of 40 to 50%. The difference being with that combination, those responses were more durable. And so very similar to what we see with systemic cutaneous disease, those patients with brain metastases who do respond to ipi-nivo seem to go into long-term response. And now the follow-up on these patients is not as long as we would wish, but you know, we're getting over a year, and it's very likely to be the case that much like we see with other immunological phenomenon, when we get true responses, those patients go into durable disease control. Now, the caveat is ipi-nivo for brain metastases is toxic, meaning that patients do get pretty sick from it. I say that in my practice, however, this is one of these situations where we may not have multiple shots on goal. And so I tend to use PD-1 monotherapy for most patients for systemic disease who kind of are in a reasonable place clinically. But for brain mets, this is a situation where you pull everything out and you just go heavy hitter right away because you may not get another chance.
Do you use PD-L1 assays in making the decision?
So I, generally speaking, don't use a PD-L1 assay in melanoma. When I say generally speaking, I don't ever do it. And the rationale there is that that actually doesn't inform my decision-making. And so when I think about, for melanoma, a monotherapy PD-1 versus a combo PD-1 CTLA-4, what I'm really asking myself is, what are the adverse prognostic features of this patient, and or would this patient have the potential to get these agents in sequence? So there are some data, although they're not as robust as we wished, for PD-1 followed by ipilimumab. And those data suggest in a small series that the impact is approximately what you get for combo, both in terms of response rate after both drugs together, as well as toxicity. So then from my clinical perspective, I'd rather than expose someone to a monotherapy PD-1, because if they respond, then I don't have to give them ipi. But in those patients who have negative or adverse prognostic features like brain metastases, like bone metastases, like rising LDH and poor performance status, there I want to come in as quickly as possible, because if we don't get something going, then you're never going to get the chance to give two drugs in sequence over a six-month period. You got to get something happening immediately.
What about in the younger patient, you know, highly motivated, but otherwise wouldn't fit the criteria of being a concern, no brain mets, et cetera?
Yeah. And so I think that that's a patient-level conversation to have with them. I personally don't think that just because someone's young, that means we necessarily need to expose them to more toxicity. There are certainly patients who are of that opinion that just give me everything you got at once. But if you explain to them that I believe that PD-1 followed by CTLA-4 is probably roughly equivalent to the combo up front, well, then again, the rationale then is, why expose yourself to toxicity if you're going to get the opportunity to get that benefit over time? And I think that this is probably where it's important to emphasize that some of these next generation combination immunotherapies really look the most exciting. So PD-1 plus IDO inhibitor may end up being roughly equivalent to ipi-nivo, but not with the side effect profile that we've been talking about.
Yeah, that would be great. One final question about brain mets. How does radiation therapy, whether it's stereotactic or whole brain, fit into your treatment approach?
So this is an area of controversy. So the data for ipi-nivo actually looked quite good. And unfortunately, our data for radiation and melanoma brain metastases is not particularly good. And so there, as a community, we are all in agreement that whole brain radiation really should not be used for advanced melanoma until the situation where there's really just no other option. And rather, stereotactic approaches should be preferred. But that being said, even stereotactic approaches can lead to radionecrosis over time, especially in the context of checkpoint blockade. As there are patients now getting out 2, 3, 5 years, the incidence of radionecrosis is going up. So in the, quote, old days, just a few years ago, we didn't have this problem because, unfortunately, patients didn't live long enough to get it. So many of us now believe that we should really be trying to use systemic therapy with combination immunotherapy for patients if they have low-volume brain metastases and there's no urgent need to radiate, that we really ought to consider systemic therapy first. And this is a whole area of investigation, and there are clinical trials ongoing to try to look at combo at sequence, and so on and so forth. And I think that this is an open area where we'll just need to learn more about it over time.
What's your vision of the, quote, radiosensitivity of melanoma, let's say, compared to other solid tumors, breast, lung cancer, or maybe, you know, hematologic cancers, lymphomas, et cetera?
Yeah, so radiosensitivity as a concept is not something that we generally employ in melanoma. You know, when we think about consolidative radiotherapy, we can say carte blanche that that does not work in melanoma. So it's never the case that, say, you didn't get a negative margin on a surgery. You would never, ever radiate that with the idea that you would clear that margin. So going to your point, we do consolidative radiation in breast cancer and head and neck cancers and some other cancers, and that's been shown to have an impact on survival that's useful over time. That is not the case in melanoma. Now, that being said, melanoma, like other tumors, is amenable to high fraction radiation. So if you do an SBRT to a specific lesion, you can get treatment effect. So it's not that radiation doesn't work at all, but rather that for all patients, it's not something that we generally think of.
But I mean, is it true that the melanoma cell itself is, you know, more resistant, is harder to kill, so to speak, than a breast cancer, or not necessarily?
Well, via DNA double-strand breaks that are induced by radiation, yes, a melanoma cell is more difficult to kill than an adenocarcinoma like breast cancer. But again, I think there's more biology under there. I think there are probably ways we could structure our radiation with immunotherapy approaches to optimize that. But generally speaking, we don't do it.
What do we know about the risk factors and incidence of melanoma and non-melanoma skin cancers?
So when we think about skin cancer, as oncologists, we're often thinking about melanoma because that's the cancer we often think about treating with systemic therapy. But it's important to point out that melanoma is actually much less common than other types of skin cancer, such as basal cell carcinomas and squamous cell carcinomas. So whereas melanoma is increasing in incidence, it's still only on the order of about 80,000 cases annually in 2016, 2017. And that really pales in comparison to squamous carcinomas, which are now approaching 300,000 to 400,000 cases annually, and basal cell carcinomas, which are now over 1 million cases annually. So in terms of the public health problem of skin cancer, the squamous and basal cell carcinomas are really a much more pervasive problem than melanoma.
And you know, it's interesting because, I mean, that's not an inconsequential number of deaths from basal cell and squamous cell, almost 1,000 deaths. I'm kind of surprised at that.
Yep.
People die of basal cell a lot.
Not a lot, but
well, I mean, 1,000 cases, that's more than like a lot of T-cell lymphomas. Just kind of interesting. Okay.
And when we think about the risk factors associated with the development of skin cancer, everyone understands that sun exposure is the major risk factor. But that being said, it is slightly different in that with melanoma, we commonly think of high-intensity sunburns, especially when people are younger, leading to long-term damage that can become melanoma. Whereas with other forms of skin cancer, it's really the chronic sun exposure over the course of one's life that leads to these lesions. So in melanoma, we commonly see a younger patient population who can develop advanced disease. Whereas with basal and squam, it's very much the case that the median age of diagnosis is now in the late 60s, kind of in 70s range, where people have had chronic sun damage over the course of their entire life. And most commonly, these lesions actually end up being small lesions that can be removed in a dermatologist's office, but people who have one squamous or basal cell lesion very commonly have more than one because it's really a phenotype of a person who spent a lot of time in the sun and who has chronic sun damage over all of their sun-exposed skin.
In terms of squamous cell, how many of these cases are related to transplant or immune suppression?
So really all skin cancers can be associated with immunosuppression. And in terms of the overall incidence or burden of squamous or basal or even melanoma in the context of transplants, it's quite low actually relative to the global burden of the disease in the population. But it's certainly the case that physicians should be aware that if a patient had a transplant or has been immunosuppressed, that knowing that that could be contributing to the development or the aggressiveness of their skin-based lesion.
Can you discuss the ONTRAC study of nicotinamide for prevention of non-melanoma skin cancers?
So there has been major progress in the area of public health around prevention in the context of non-melanoma skin cancer. That was presented a few years ago at ASCO and published in the New England Journal. It was this on-track study where from Australia, they randomized patients to either get a placebo or to receive the vitamin nicotinamide at 500 milligrams twice a day. And this is really a very, very useful study. And when we think about using vitamins, they often get thrown around, that there's no dose consistency, they're not followed properly. But in this study, it was quite a rigorous prospective study, and they really showed a dramatic reduction in the incidence of basal and squamous skin cancers. Again, not melanoma, basal and squamous cancers, with the use of nicotinamide 500 milligrams BID. Again, showing that the relative reduction was on the order of about 20%, and this was effective both for basals and squames. The hazard was actually 0.77.
So it's 23% reduction.
Yeah, 23% reduction. But when you think about the overall disease burden, like we were thinking about in the epidemiological perspective, and relative to other kinds of cancer, that's a dramatic decrease in the overall disease burden in the population. And I think the most important part of this, perhaps, is that nicotinamide is really not toxic at all. It's a vitamin supplement you can take. It's not going to cause any problems of any significant threshold. So really for patients, now in this study, it was important to point out that patients had to have at least 2 non-melanoma skin cancers to be eligible for this study. But again, for the population of patients who have chronic sun damage, that's a fairly common incidence. And so if you've had more than 1 or 2 squamous or basal cell cancers, taking nicotinamide is a very reasonable consideration and is now compendium listed from major cancer societies.
That's really fascinating. Any evidence or reason to think it would be helpful to people with an established cancer or even metastatic disease? What's the mechanism, incidentally?
You know, I'm not sure the mechanism is completely worked out. You know, I think it is around sort of immune surveillance, but I don't know that that's been elucidated to the degree that we'd want to comment on it absolutely. In terms of taking it in the metastatic setting, I think there's little harm, although to date we don't have evidence that says that that would augment the treatment effect.
It's really interesting. You want to talk a little bit about basal cell?
Yeah, so in the non-melanoma skin cancer world, basal cells and squamous cell carcinomas, again, are less frequent, but can be quite devastating. And so for basal cell carcinomas, we think about the basal cells are cells that sit just below the epidermis, in the dermis, and they're really pluripotent progenitor cells that can do quite a few things. They generally tend to have less metastatic potential, but can really cause quite problematic things in terms of local aggression. And generally speaking, they can be removed, but upon recurrence or lack of complete excision, they can start to cause severe dermatological problems, both from a cosmetic as well as a functional perspective. And so when we think about the biology of basal cell carcinoma, it's interesting to look at the syndrome known as basal cell nevus syndrome, which really can help us understand why do these things happen. So basal cell nevus syndrome is an autosomal dominant syndrome that has a prevalence on the order of about 1 in 50 to 250,000 people. And these are folks that develop really hundreds of basal cell carcinomas all over their body. These lesions do look very similar to sporadic or sun-induced basal cell carcinomas, and on a molecular level, these lesions have been identified to have patched mutations as the most common lesion that leads to this syndrome. So germline mutation in patched will lead to this recurrent basal cell carcinoma syndrome. And that's very interesting then when you look at what's going on with sporadic or sun-induced basal cell carcinomas, where we see actually very similar biology in that the majority of basal cell carcinomas that are in the context of sun exposure have a similar genetic lesion. Now, it can happen in different ways, but you can get activating mutations in this pathway in smoothened, which regulates patched, in about 10 to 20% of basal cell carcinomas. But in others, you can have epigenetic regulation and other ways to really sort of impact on this pathway. And that really suggests that this hedgehog pathway, which is the name of this overall smoothened patched pathway, really regulates this basal cell carcinoma phenomenon in multiple settings.
Can I just ask a simple question? It was, why is it called basal cell nevus syndrome? Are they nevuses?
So the lesions that develop are nevi-like, and these patients don't tend to die from basal cell nevus syndrome immediately, meaning they will have these lesions all over their body for extended periods of time without developing metastatic disease. And so that's why it's referred to as nevus syndrome.
Interesting. You want to talk a little bit more about sort of the biology here?
Sure. So the hedgehog signaling pathway, under wild-type conditions, patched interacts with smoothened to shut down signaling through this pathway. But when patched is not regulating smoothened, you get downstream activation of these different genes, including GLE proteins that eventually lead to a transcription factor to activation of hedgehog target pathway genes. The drug development in this space is evaluating molecules that impact on the various different signaling nodes in this pathway to interrupt signaling here, such that we might be able to shut down hedgehog signaling and lead to reduction of hedgehog-driven cancers like basal cell carcinoma. And multiple hedgehog inhibitors have come forward into clinic now. There are two of them. One is vesmodegib. In the phase 2 study of vesmodegib in the metastatic basal cell carcinoma population, as well as with the locally advanced basal cell carcinoma population. As might be expected, the therapy is more efficacious in the locally advanced setting than in the metastatic setting. But in both, you can see rather dramatic responses at more than 30% tumor reduction in the locally advanced setting in more than 50% of patients. And in the metastatic setting, in more of a 20 to 30% therapy setting. Now, that's quite important because other therapies, systemic therapies for advanced or locally advanced disease for basal cell carcinoma really are of limited utility. We don't have particularly effective systemic therapies. We do use chemotherapy. However, it tends to be quite toxic without necessarily a big impact. The other drug of hedgehog inhibitor that's available in clinical practice is sonatinib. And again, the sample sizes are smaller in these investigations. However, the data sets look fairly similar, such that in the locally advanced basal cell carcinoma setting, you can see response rate to sonatinib of about 50%. And again, then in the metastatic setting, it's lower, again, on the order of about 20-ish percent. But again, both of these agents being quite useful to manage basal cell carcinoma when it cannot be removed by surgery. Now, the issue with hedgehog inhibitors is that they are not the most easily tolerated drugs to take, and the adverse events associated with sonatinib, these are really class effect for hedgehog inhibitors. Patients will complain of muscle spasms, hair loss, dysgeusia or abdominal discomfort, nausea, et cetera, so really GI-like symptoms that can develop. And these can really be, unfortunately, quite dose-limiting, meaning that patients will have a difficult time maintaining oral hydration and food intake in the context of these drugs, and it's very much the case that sometimes drug interruption is required or treatment holiday because patients just have difficulty tolerating it out over an extended period of time.
Anything particularly typical about the muscle spasms? When do they occur, and is there anything you can do about it?
I think that managing the muscle spasms is really a patient per patient sort of thing. We see people who actually take this drug and don't get them at all. When we see other people, though, they have them quite dramatic. And so we recommend NSAIDs. We recommend trying to sort of sometimes take just short treatment breaks, and exercise can sometimes help with those as well.
Any comment about this issue of survival?
These were not randomized controlled studies that have led to the approval of these agents, so it's been an open question and a debate in the field about the long-term efficacy of hedgehog inhibitors. And multiple case series have been presented and really compared with historical series to try to make the case that there is an impact on long-term survival. The Kaplan-Meier estimate for overall survival in the vesmodegib clinical trials demonstrating a one-year landmark survival at about 85%. If you take the largest series from the literature, we would expect only approximately 50 to 60% of patients to still be alive at 1 year. So while these are not a randomized and direct comparison, it does appear that there's a benefit to those patients who are taking hedgehog inhibitors in terms of improving overall survival.
I don't know how often in your own practice you actually see a patient or you treat a patient with one of these agents. Have you had patients like in the last year or so die? What do people die from? Do they get mets?
There, unfortunately, are a couple of different scenarios for patients who have locally advanced basal cell or squamous cancers. One can be that the locally invasive aspect eventually can become metastatic, and that most commonly leads to lung metastases, somewhat like a sarcoma or a head and neck cancer, where eventually just the tumor burden overwhelms the patient. But also very commonly, unfortunately, are the problems with management of the local invasion of the lesion. So I have a patient that I'm remembering who had a basal cell on his temple, and unfortunately that lesion was quite aggressive, eventually eroding into his skull. And so management of that area was very difficult. It became a radiotherapy refractory lesion, and that area would eventually get infected. And we had the person on long-term antibiotics, and eventually you have breakthrough even with the antibiotics, and you get meningitis, et cetera, and you can really lead to sort of infectious consequences for these patients.
You know, I've heard from a lot of people about the challenges of using these drugs. You mentioned the toxicities and the fact that it's pretty hard to keep people on them for a really long time, trying to use intermittent treatment, et cetera. But is there also evidence that they actually develop sort of a pharmacologic resistance, or is it just you can't get the hedgehog inhibitors into them clinically?
No, it's very much the case that resistance will eventually develop. And then the median time on treatment for most patients is less than a year. And that's actually, generally speaking, due to treatment resistance. Often what will happen with these drugs is that patients will have a complaint about, you know, how they're having difficulty with the drugs, and you take a treatment break, but the tumors will come back, and therefore the patients are more amenable to try to find a way to fight through. Eventually, unfortunately, however, similar to many, if not all, targeted therapies, we do eventually see treatment resistance, and at that point, then the disease usually takes off and starts to grow much more aggressively.
So why don't we hear about a case from your practice? You have a 62-year-old man with basal cell. What happened there?
Yeah, so this individual was, I mean, could be just about any of us, slightly overweight with diabetes, and really had a long history of sun exposure. And he developed a lesion on his temple, which he observed it, and his wife was nagging at him to try to get it removed. Eventually did see a dermatologist and had it biopsied, and it came back as a basal cell carcinoma. And this is a person who had had previous lesions, actinic keratoses, and other things taken off of his skin. Really didn't worry about it too much, but was observed that after the lesion was resected, that it turned out that the margins actually were positive. And so they went back and they did a wider excision of the lesion. And this time, again, the margins were close, but they felt confident at least that they had removed the basal cell carcinoma at that point.
Just out of curiosity, and a lot of times I have in my mind when I hear about locally advanced basal cell, a person who's on the fringe of society, who's not getting medical care. What about this man?
Oh, so absolutely not, for this guy at least. I mean, this was a very well-off gentleman who, you know, had had a lot of sun exposure over the course of his life and really just kind of thought, this just isn't a big deal. It's a little bump on my skin. And it really took quite a bit to get that person to the doctor. And I think this really does raise that as we get older in society these days, with the amount of sun exposure that the population is taking, it's really going to become essential that people do see their dermatologist and really consider having any new lesion biopsied and removed.
So what was the next step with this man?
So for this man, you know, after this lesion was removed, it was assumed that things are taken care of and it's not going to be a big issue. Unfortunately, it was not more than about 6 months before the skin graft that was required to close the previous lesion started to sort of change in color and eventually became nodular. And so at that point, he returned to the dermatologist, or I think actually a surgeon at that point, and a re-biopsy of the area was taken and unfortunately showed that there was still residual or locally recurrent basal cell carcinoma that was present. And so that was quite unfortunate. He did have an attempted resection of that lesion again, but unfortunately, again, had positive margins on the re-resection and now had a very significant problem because now he had a surgical wound that actually would not heal right because there was residual basal cell carcinoma that was present. So a patient was referred to a radiation oncologist and had radiation to that area. Again, unfortunately, while there was some initial control of the disease for a period of time, over a relatively short period of time, we start to see a disease outgrowth, again, now sort of in more of a miliary pattern extending into the skin going sideways. And what we saw was that the initial surgical lesion really started to degrade and started to fall apart, such that now there was an open wound that really wouldn't heal after multiple surgeries and radiation. So biopsy of that lesion did show residual basal cell carcinoma. And in that time, unfortunately, he was referred to us being deemed to be unresectable basal cell carcinoma. So realize that this is a patient that not with metastatic disease like we would commonly think about in the medical oncology setting, but rather with a local problem of a lesion on his temple, now with basically a hole in his skin for opportunistic infections to take root.
Just to clarify, at the point he saw you, had he seen a medical oncologist?
To that point, he had not seen a medical oncologist because this had been managed with a dermatologist and a surgeon as well as a radiation oncologist, but there hadn't been thought to have a role for a medical oncologist at that point. So this patient was in the community being managed by his providers there.
How long ago was this?
This odyssey for him started less than 2 years ago. He got referred to me more about a year ago.
Because I am kind of curious, since it's, you know, not that common out there and certainly not common in medical oncology, whether you're seeing patients. I mean, to me, it sounds like it's maybe a little before you got stereotactic radiation that maybe you shouldn't be considered for a hedgehog inhibitor before that.
Yeah, that's a very reasonable question. I think that that's an area that's sort of unknown and this gets to workflows in, you know, the community oncology setting. I don't know that it's right or wrong. There aren't any studies that look at radiation before or after hedgehog inhibitors, but you could actually ask a quality of life question that if we had intervened earlier, would he not quite as much of an issue? But I think that's hard to say.
No, I mean, I was just wondering in terms of awareness in dermatologists and surgeons about hedgehog inhibitors, you would think if they had somebody with, you know, an unresectable one, they would be aware that these agents are there.
Yeah, but I think that uptake in the dermatologic as well as the dermatological surgical approach or settings, I think they are broadly aware. And I think it often comes down to the patient in front of you. Do you as the physician think, oh, I can get this and I can really take care of this problem? I think often that takes us down that route, sometimes to a place where perhaps if we had a few steps earlier, you know, reconsidered, we might have made a different calculation.
So what happened next?
So being deemed unresectable, he came to see me, and the conversation then was really about how are we going to manage this as long as we possibly can. And we did present options to him of hedgehog inhibitor, which for all the reasons around hedgehog signaling to basal cell carcinoma could be very reasonable. We did discuss platinum-based chemotherapy as a potential option, as well as a few clinical trials. And there are some things in the immunotherapy world, as well as just in the phase one world that might be of interest. Given the sort of biology, he was a sophisticated guy, and he said, yes, I'd like to try the hedgehog inhibitor. We did educate him around the potential toxicities of the drug, and he did start taking it. And very quickly, I mean, within days, he did see actually the area start to improve. And so he had less oozing around the area, and just in general, it looked better. Unfortunately, he also very quickly started to notice that taking the drug wasn't as easy as he had expected it to be.
And he got Vismo, did you?
Yes, but he started to develop abdominal discomfort and a sense of nausea, and he wasn't so much someone who had the muscle aches, but rather just kind of didn't feel well all the time. And so he struggled through that, and we tried some different things around his diet and trying to get him the appropriate nutrition, but by about 3 months, even though we had dramatic treatment effect, we had really gotten to a place where he was kind of fed up with this because it was really impacting on his quality of life. And so he said, well, you know, what will happen if we stop? And I said, well, it'll probably grow back, but it's reasonable to give it a try. So we did, but unfortunately, it only took a few weeks before we started to see the lesion returning. And so we did then transition to put him back on the hedgehog inhibitor and did various things about dose reduction and some interruptions and continued on. But unfortunately, eventually he did develop resistance and we saw outgrowth of the tumor with the surgical area again starting to break down. And we realized that he had had progression of disease at that site. Thereafter, we did try a few other things with standard chemotherapy as well as some off-label sorts of approaches, but none of those really made a real big difference. And eventually, unfortunately, he did develop an opportunistic infection that could not be controlled adequately, and he did pass away.
Oh, what a terrible story. It seems like he probably got treated with Vismodegib maybe before Sonodegib was approved, but I am just sort of curious. Now that both are available, how do you choose between the two?
I think that when I look at the data sets, it's not entirely clear to me that one is distinctly better than the other. So this sometimes comes down to formulary questions about what's available to a patient. We did start using Vismodegib earlier, so we have a little bit more experience with it, but it's not that one I think necessarily is better than another per se. So in my practice, you know, it's a little bit path of least resistance, and the one that we can get for the patient is the one that we use.
Let's talk a little bit about Merkel cell, though, because, I mean, amazingly, you actually have a new agent approved.
Yeah, so Merkel cell carcinoma is another form of skin cancer, but again, much more rare. So only approximately 2,000 cases per year in the United States. And this is a very interesting disease that has a complex biology that's both related to infection as well as exposure risk in the environment. And so we see these lesions most commonly in older adults over the age of 50, but commonly, honestly, more in the late 60s and 70s, people who have had a high degree of UV ionizing radiation exposure from the sun, and also patients who have had a history of immunosuppression. And that can be in the context of a transplant, it can be in the context of HIV and several others. Unfortunately, this is a very aggressive form of cancer, meaning that more than 40% of patients who develop a cutaneous Merkel cell cancer will develop metastatic disease, and often quite rapidly, such that historically, we describe the median survival in the context of metastatic disease at less than a year at about 9.6 months. Very interestingly, this disease stratifies in between those that are associated with a viral etiology and those that are not. But about 80% of patients who develop a Merkel cell carcinoma, we can find evidence of infection for the Merkel cell polyoma virus. And that is actually a virus which exists at normal circumstances on almost everyone's skin. It just turns out that most of us don't get Merkel cell carcinoma, presumably from immune surveillance that will eliminate the virus. But in some folks, unfortunately, it doesn't, and it can develop Merkel cell. It is important to point out that 20% of Merkel cells do not harbor this virus. And in those patients that have been profiled to date, we see quite extreme mutational loads. And that's where we see dramatic effect of sun exposure leading to cancer, with the mutation of common genes, as you'd expect, like P53, RB, and all of these sort of canonical cancer-driving genes.
So just to clarify, though, in terms of the viral-related ones, is the issue there some kind of immune deficiency or something primarily?
Yeah, so we do believe there's some element of immunodeficiency that leads to the development of Merkel cell, but it's not as easy as being to be able to identify one gene per se. We note this association in clinical settings with immunosuppressive medications like steroids, anti-TNF, and so on and so forth in the context of transplant. But certainly there are people who develop Merkel cell who have no history of any sort of direct immunosuppression and who otherwise don't manifest symptoms of a immunodeficiency syndrome. So we don't really understand in those patients what exactly is going on. That being said, this is a tumor that we've now learned can be dramatically amenable to immunotherapy. And so because of the viral etiology, these tumors commonly have very high expression of PD-L1 and infiltration of T cells. So historically, our management of Merkel cell carcinoma is that we don't have a direct FDA approval, but rather, just like other small cell cancer, like small cell lung cancer, which is also a neuroendocrine tumor, and I didn't point that out earlier, but Merkel cell carcinoma is also a neuroendocrine tumor, we treat it very similar to small cell cancer with platinum plus etoposide chemotherapy. And we've done that historically. That has definitely been, before very recently, the standard frontline therapy for metastatic disease. It's also sometimes used for adjuvant therapy as well, where radiation is probably more common, however. That being said, much like small cell carcinoma of the lung, we see that responses are quite common initially, but rarely very durable. The historical data set for progression-free survival on chemotherapy for Merkel cell carcinoma shows there are rare patients that go out a long period of time, but the median, unfortunately, is on the order of just over 3 months in terms of progression-free survival on this chemotherapy.
Just a side question, you mentioned that it's a neuroendocrine tumor, and I can't remember what the scan is that you do in people with GI neuroendocrine tumors and the radiolabeled lutetate thing that's being used. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
But those scans are more commonly used for low-grade neuroendocrine tumors in the liver or in the pancreas, as opposed to these neuroendocrine tumors, much like small cell, are much, much more aggressive. And so we tend not to use those sort of radiolabeled investigations in Merkel cell carcinoma.
Right. So how about checkpoint inhibitors?
So because of the high degree of T cell infiltration associated with the virus in Merkel cell carcinoma, there's been dramatic progress with the development of PD-1 and PD-L1 blockade for this disease. A first presentation of pembrolizumab for Merkel cell carcinoma showing that in the initial series, more than 50% of patients in the frontline setting had RECIST quality partial responses to treatment. And these can be quite dramatic, meaning within days, we see the tumor starting to shrink massively. And so these are quite effective therapies, pembrolizumab, as well as avelumab, the PD-L1 antibody. Again, both in the second line after chemotherapy and in the frontline setting, both have been shown to be highly effective. And I'll point out that avelumab has actually gained regulatory approval as the standard PD-L1 therapy in this space, although pembrolizumab also has a compendium listing with the NCCN. The kinetics of treatment response and the efficacy of treatment out over time, again, from the CITN study of pembrolizumab in Merkel cell carcinoma, shows the majority of patients had relatively rapid decrease in the sum diameter of their lesions, which was durable out over extended periods of time. The time to response, again, showing here in the dots, again, essentially at the time of first scan, we see that most patients actually are already demonstrating a RECIST quality response. And so in this study, the initial reported response rate was approximately 70%. Subsequent studies have described that in the frontline setting, more around 50% response rate. In the second line setting, that also drops a little bit further. But really, there's no question that PD-1 and PD-L1 blocking antibodies have become a default standard of care treatment for Merkel cell carcinoma and really should be considered for patients with reasonable performance status, probably in the frontline setting. It isn't to say that we don't use chemotherapy for these patients anymore, however, because a lot of these patients will present with bulky metastatic disease, where we really have to think about doing something aggressively immediately to try to get their symptoms under control. But in my practice, I really try to convert patients over to immunotherapy really as quickly as we can, because I think that the long-term benefit from PD-1 or PD-L1 blocking antibodies really dwarfs any kind of benefit from chemotherapy outside of that initial benefit that you might get from tumor debulking.
You had a patient, a 61-year-old man with Merkel cell. What happened there?
So recently, I had a patient who presented to see me, and he noted that really over a very short period of time, only a few weeks, he had had a bump just above his left elbow, which had gone from being something that he noticed to being the size of like a tennis ball. It really had just dramatically and rapidly increased in size. And so that lesion was biopsied and came back showing Merkel cell carcinoma. We then went forward and did a PET scan because of the size of this lesion and saw axillary lymphadenopathy as well. And so I had a discussion because the standard of care obviously would be to try to resect these lesions in the local and in the regional lymph node basin. However, the surgeon said, you know, this is a very aggressive disease. It's bulky. I'm not totally sure I'm going to be able to get it. So in this patient, we talked about using immunotherapy, but because of how fast the cancer was growing, we actually chose to use platinum-based chemotherapy. And we gave the patient 3 cycles actually of cisplatin plus etoposide and saw a dramatic shrinkage of the tumor. So the tumor on his elbow nearly resolved, and the palpable lymphadenopathy actually decreased quite a bit as well. So the patient was then able to actually transition to go to the operating room and had wide local excision above the elbow as well as axillary completion lymph node dissection. Interestingly, whereas on the elbow there was no residual disease, in the axilla there still actually was a deep-seated lymph node mass. And so given that, we actually went forward with adjuvant radiotherapy both to the arm and to the axilla, which is importantly a standard of care in the adjuvant setting to use radiation. So we then continued to follow the patient forward. We didn't give him more chemotherapy because chemotherapy has not been associated with an overall survival advantage in the adjuvant setting, but continued to watch. And unfortunately, fairly quickly, within 6 months, he had developed abdominal discomfort, and restaging imaging now already showed liver metastases and omental caking. And so again, the question was what to do. And in discussion about the available options, we said, well, there's this benefit to PD-1, PD-L1. So we should go forward and use avelumab as a frontline therapy. So we started avelumab, and I think the patient got 2 doses. But unfortunately, his symptoms actually continued to accelerate with worsening abdominal pain and weight loss. And he got hospitalized. And when he was discharged, we again had further conversation. It really wasn't clear that we'd given him a real shot at immunotherapy. He'd only gotten a few doses, but it was just clinically obvious that we couldn't go further down that route. So we again switched back to cisplatin plus etoposide chemotherapy, and he had a marked improvement in his symptoms of abdominal discomfort. He was able to eat, and we actually saw after 2 cycles and then again after 4, dramatic reduction in his overall tumor burden. So again, then at that point, we said, okay, why don't we give immunotherapy a try again? Now we're in a lower disease volume setting. Symptoms are better. So we reinitiated avelumab at that point, and actually, he's still in a stable disease situation, but he's now gone more than 6 months on that therapy and seems to be tolerating that quite well. So I think that this really emphasizes how clinical practice is not what we do in clinical trials, and really, we manage the patient that's in front of us, but we can use the concepts that have been taken from randomized phase 3 trials and try to incorporate that into the management of our individual patients. So with this patient, you know, my priority was to get him to immunotherapy over time, but it took a couple of shots on goal in order to do that. We had to debulk him and get him into a clinical situation where we thought the immunotherapy would have a reasonable shot. And so far, that has been an effective strategy.
And this case kind of reinforces what you're saying about it being an aggressive disease. I'm kind of curious, if you look at Ki-67 or mitotic rate or whatever, what do you see?
So similar to small cell lung cancer, you see very high rates of Ki-67 positive cancer cells in Merkel cell carcinoma, especially in the metastatic setting. When you resect, if you get resections of these lesions from lymph nodes or other places, you really just see sheets of these neuroendocrine cells that are looking quite dangerous and very, very aggressive.
Fascinating. Any data or thoughts about using combined therapy with anti-PD-1 and anti-CTLA-4 in Merkel cell?
So absolutely. There's an interest in combination checkpoint blockade in Merkel cell, just like there is in every other kind of cancer. And discussions have been had around using CTLA-4 plus PD-1-based immunotherapy. The caveat there is that the patient population for which you'd be employing this is not the same as what we've seen in melanoma, because the majority of patients who have Merkel cell carcinoma are going to be of advanced age, and therefore their ability to tolerate the side effect profile associated with that combination therapy, I think, is a little bit more in doubt. So those sorts of questions are being asked, and clinical trials to investigate those questions are coming forward. I think there we're going to need a lot more flexibility around the dosing strategy associated with the CTLA-4 antibody, whether it's to drop it from 3 mg/kg to 1 mg/kg for ipilimumab, or perhaps to space out the dosing, not every 3 weeks, but rather every 6 weeks. I think we're going to have to take a broader approach, because unfortunately, the idea that we're going to be inducing a grade 3-4 immune-related adverse events in more than 50% of our octogenarians, I think, is going to be problematic in clinical practice.
So I want to finish out and ask for your thoughts about one other non-melanoma skin cancer, which is squamous cell cancer, and sort of what the epidemiology of that is, particularly as it relates to oncologists and where we are today with therapy, and particularly the issue of checkpoint inhibitors.
Yeah, so squamous cell cancer of the skin is a, again, much more common entity than melanoma, being on the order of 300,000 to 400,000 cases annually in the U.S. Again, whereas melanoma is associated with high-intensity sunburns, squamous cell cancers are really associated with long-term exposure to ionizing radiation or UV light over the course of one's life, so that people often develop multiple of these lesions later in life in their 60s and 70s. Again, these are generally speaking easily managed with local resection, either by Mohs surgery or even sometimes a surgical resection, but they can usually manage locally. Unfortunately, they can develop as locally recurrent lesions after surgery, and a small fraction do develop metastatic disease. And most commonly, that will be to regional lymph nodes and or to the lung. And management of locally advanced or metastatic squamous cell carcinoma from the skin follows algorithms actually that are fairly similar to what is more commonly thought of as oropharynx head and neck cancer. And so we think about platinum-based chemotherapy, we think about radiation, we think about EGFR inhibitors like cetuximab, but most recently we really started to focus on the utility of immunotherapy in that space, because it's been known for quite a while, and it completely makes sense that the driving etiology of these lesions is the tremendous amount of sun damage. So the number of mutations that we see in squamous cell cancers of the skin are dramatically high. And so following along on the research underpinning the utility of checkpoint blockade in other cancers, there's a hypothesis then that PD-1-based immunotherapy might be quite effective in squamous cell carcinoma of the skin, given the number of putative mutations or neoantigens that might be present.
Can you comment on the recent data on cemiplimab for squamous cell carcinoma?
At ASCO was the first presentation of a PD-1 antibody specifically in squamous cancer of the skin. And there we did see a quite dramatic response rate on the order of 50%. And actually in a subset was 70% of patients responding. And larger data series are coming forward, with one agent now being granted a breakthrough designation for squamous cell carcinoma of the skin. It was presented at ASCO.
But this is just squamous of the skin, or has it been used in other cancers?
Well, their trial is in other cancers as well.
Wow, that is interesting. Fascinating. We should note that subsequent to recording this discussion, nivolumab was approved for the adjuvant treatment of patients with melanoma with involvement of lymph nodes, or in patients with metastatic disease who've undergone complete resection. Nivolumab was previously approved for the treatment of patients with unresectable or metastatic melanoma. This concludes our program. Special thanks to our faculty, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Dermatologic Oncology Update.